that you see on the screen here. All right, so we're continuing our study in Proverbs, and we're going to be in Proverbs chapter 10 today. And I know we, to refresh your memory, we discussed Proverbs chapter 9 like two Sundays ago, and I told Caleb to tell you that we were going to be doing topical after he finished chapter 9, and that was partly true. I told him to tell you something that wasn't really true, so that's my fault. But we're going to stay in chapter 10 and just teach through most of chapter 10, because once you get past Proverbs chapter 9, you can teach chapters 1 through 9, just kind of verse by verse, chapter by chapter. But once you get past chapter 9, it just sort of goes all over the place. The book does. So the topics come to us very quickly once you get to chapter 10 and beyond, and they can seem kind of random in the book of Proverbs. You'll be reading a verse, and it'll be like on this topic, and then you read the next. It's a totally change of subject. So why is that the pattern for the rest of the book? Well, most people teach topically after chapter 9, and that's what we're going to start doing next week. But we wanted to teach you one chapter that seems random, and I'll explain why. Because whenever you read Proverbs, you might ask why the writers didn't just categorize like a file system the verses on certain topics together like in one place. Like, why aren't all the verses on work in the same area? And then words and marriage and sexuality. Why aren't they like topic? Why aren't they categorized like that in this book? Wouldn't it be easier to find verses on a topic if they're just all in one location? Well, it would be easier, but I believe that God writes it this way in kind of a random way for a purpose. Because whenever you read Proverbs chapter 10, each verse is about a different topic. And it's going to create this like swirl effect. Like you will feel like you're in a tornado of ideas whenever you read chapter 10 and beyond. Because Proverbs comes to us in this swirl of random topics, because that's how life comes at you. So whenever you wake up in the morning, your first decision deals with what? Laziness. Am I going to get out of bed? Am I going to hit snooze for the 10th time this morning? You get up, you walk to the bathroom, you realize your little brother's already in there, and so you lose your temper. That's anger. You shout some insults through the door, words again. You go to the kitchen for breakfast and your mom asks you if you finished your project from last night, laziness. And you roll your eyes, respect, and you give her a sarcastic response, words again, right? You sit down to eat and you start scrolling through your phone and you have 25 unread messages in a thread about some friendship drama. Friendship is in the book of Proverbs as well. And now you have a lot that you need to, that you want to say, words again. You have one group of friends inviting you to a crazy party on Saturday night. That's Lady Folly. And another group inviting you to Connect Weekend. That's Lady Wisdom talking to you right there, okay? And so we don't wake up in the morning and just deal with one topic at a time in logically planned order. From the time you get up in the morning, life comes at us in the same kind of fluid chaos in which Proverbs is written. So that's why I think God wrote it the way he did, because Proverbs is messy because life is messy. It's also how parenting works. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, God says to the people of Israel, "And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise." This is a section called, it's part of the Great Shema, where the nation of Israel is being told by God, this is how you are to talk about the law and all that God has commanded to your children. And this is what he says to parents. So it doesn't tell parents, like, just have a class, a session each day that just focuses on the law. It says it's going to permeate your whole day. You're going to talk about it as you sit down, as you lay down, as you get up, as you walk by the way. So God doesn't tell parents to, you know, sit down their kids and tell them all they know about work or money in one session. Life doesn't work that way. If we're going to teach our kids how life works, it's going to happen throughout the day. So how much time do you spend, like, waking up and sitting and walking around and lying down? That's your entire day. That encompasses your entire day. So parenting doesn't work like this. Like Monday, we're going to learn about dating and marriage. And then Tuesday, we're going to learn about work. And then Wednesday, we'll learn about friendship. As life happens, we as parents share wisdom with our kids. Sometimes, how many of you all have parents that they like to turn situations into life lessons to you? Like, raise your hand. Hopefully it's all of you. Hopefully all your hands are up. And what do you do when they do that? You're like, you roll your eyes. You're like, oh, everything doesn't have to be a life lesson, mom or dad, right? That's what you say to them. And you say things like, I already know what you're going to say. I know what you're going to say. And they're like, here it comes. Here comes the life lesson. So you get frustrated. But listen, when your parents do that, they're following Deuteronomy chapter 6. That's how it should look. That throughout the day, as things arise, as things come your way, that they're going to instill wisdom in those situations and talk about those things. So they are following. So just so you know, and put you in your place, they are following God when they do that to you. All right, that's how it works. Now, can a parent do overkill? Yes, we can do that sometimes. Like, everything shouldn't be a life lesson. We get that. But there should still be these things happening throughout the day and throughout your life. This is just how we do it. So there's really, we're going to look today at really how to read Proverbs with a gospel lens. I don't know why I went back to that slide. I'm like way off of my slides here. What happened? All right, here we go. So there's the wrong way to read Proverbs. So this is reading Proverbs with a gospel lens. That's our main topic today. There's the wrong way to read it, which is this. If I obey the words of Proverbs, God will accept me. That's how some read this book, and that's the wrong way to read the book. It's very easy to read the book of Proverbs and get caught up in just behavior modification. Like, I just need to do what it says to do, like just the actions it says to do, and then I'm good. Because it does appear sometimes like the book is saying that. Like, if you do these things, plug in the formula, you're going to get good things and good blessings. And it's like, that's partly true, right? We talked about the idea that Proverbs is, they're generally true, but they're not always true. Okay, a promise is always true. A proverb is generally true. So you can't read the book and say, if I obey these words, God's going to accept me. That's reading it like a Pharisee. That's reading it, if you read it that way, it's going to lead to pride if you succeed and to misery if you fail. If you come at this book with like a very legalistic Pharisee mindset, then if you're successful at doing the formula, then you're going to be prideful about it. If you fail at the formula, it's going to lead to misery. And that's a no-win situation. So the right way to read the book is with a gospel lens. I obey because God has already accepted me through the blood of Jesus Christ. This would apply to someone who's already a Christian. This statement would not apply to someone who's not yet a Christ follower, right? Because you've not placed your faith and trust in Christ, that means the perfection of Christ has not been applied to you yet because you've not placed your faith and trust in him. So, but the right way to read it, if you're a Christian, is that the behaviors that we see in Proverbs are what God produces in people who belong to him. That's how you should read this book. So in chapter 9, we learned that when we don't embrace God's wisdom, it shows we're worshiping idols instead of Jesus. So we have two things vying for our attention. It's Lady Wisdom. We've talked about how Lady Wisdom is really essentially Jesus, because when you read the book, you can say, these are the things that Jesus wants me to learn. It's all coming from him, essentially. And there's Lady Wisdom, which is the same thing as Jesus, essentially. And there's Lady Folly, who represents idolatry. And so you and I cannot be wise without a relationship with Jesus. It can't happen. The alternative is a relationship with idols. If we see patterns of foolishness in our lives, it reveals something. It reveals that we're worshiping something or someone other than Jesus. So how do you and I know where we struggle with idolatry? It's very simple. Follow the foolishness. Where do you make foolish decisions? Where do you and I make foolish decisions? Do you ignore people when they try to give you advice? Do you make foolish money decisions? Do you struggle with laziness? Then comfort might be your idol. Some parents can turn their children into idols And they want to do all they can to please their kids and appease their kids, never disciplining them, never giving consequences, just so their kids will be happy. That's an idolatry in the family, a parent idolizing their kids. So how do we know where the idols are? Well, follow the foolishness in our lives, and it will lead you to where the idols are located in your heart and in your mind. So I want to show my quick outline today is that Jesus gives wisdom in different areas of our lives. And so the first point is Jesus gives wisdom for our work and our money. Look at Proverbs 10, verses 2 through 5. It says, treasures gained by wickedness do not profit, but righteousness delivers from death. The Lord does not let the righteous go hungry, but he thwarts the craving of the wicked. A slack hand, meaning like a lazy hand, causes poverty, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. He who gathers in summer is a prudent son, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who brings shame. So there are people, that first verse in verse number 2, treasures gained by wickedness do not profit. Well, you can look around the world and see people that gain things, gain money, gain riches by doing evil things. We see it all the time. They commit crimes. They do unethical things, immoral things. And many seem to get away with it. So what is Solomon saying here when he says these words? Eventually we know it's going to catch up with him. It might happen in this life. It might happen in the life after. But eventually it's going to catch up to them. I had this weird, don't take this the wrong way, I had this weird fascination with mobsters, like mafia people. Not like to glory in what they do. I just am fascinated by the idea that someone could have like this organized crime situation and somehow get away with it. And it's like the authorities know they're doing it and know they're doing bad stuff and know their names, know where they live and all those things about them, but they can't catch them sometimes. That's just kind of fascinating to me. Like, how do these people, some of them are brilliant in like how smart they are, and if they would just use those gifts for like something good and not bad, it'd probably be amazing. But they find these ways to like create these organized crime groups. So recently I got caught, I was watching this this Netflix thing on John Gotti, a guy in New York City who a long time ago was this mobster guy. And it was a documentary about him, and I didn't know much about the guy, but I'm watching it, and I learned that he went to prison kind of early in his life for some stuff. Gets out 4 years later. He's arrested again for murder. Then gets out again. I'm like, how do you get arrested for murder and then get out? Like, how does that work? Well, somehow he pulls it off and he's on the streets walking around as a murderer. And then he has this other mafia boss murdered that was like in the same crime family that he was a part of. And he takes this guy out because he wants to be the boss of this crime family. Then the FBI ends up bugging the place where he's hanging out with his little cronies and making plans and stuff. And then they found evidence, of course, through the bugging system that he was the one who killed the other guy. And they now have evidence tying him to the murder. He's arrested again. He spends the rest of his life in prison. He dies of cancer in prison. So for a while, made a lot of money. He got away with a lot of things. And he became like this kind of folk hero. There were people that were mad that he was being caught and like investigated by the FBI and the police because they see him as like this folk hero in a way for some reason. But eventually it catches up to him and he ends up spending the rest of his life in prison and he dies of cancer there in prison. If we take shortcuts to gain wealth, you might get rich quickly. That might happen for some people, but eventually it's all gonna implode. There are some that appear to get away with it. That's not going to last forever. There are people that they attempt to use their wealth to delay death as long as possible. If you think about how people use money, people often use money just simply to delay death as long as they can. That's ultimately what their life becomes about. But there's only one thing that can protect us from eternal death, and it's the righteousness of Christ. The words here are, but righteousness delivers from death. Ultimately, it points to the righteousness of Christ. If you're a Christ follower, then ultimately, nothing that's like ultimately bad can ever truly get to you because you have the righteousness of Christ applied to you. So even the things in this life that are bad that happen to you, ultimately don't bring eternal harm to you because you're protected by the righteousness of Christ. That's what's being referred to here in verse 2. And then in verse 3, it says another statement that you're like, wait a second, this seems to defy reality. It says, the Lord does not let the righteous go hungry. Now, do you think that there are people in here where we live and also around the world that are Christ followers that are currently going hungry? Do you think that happens? Yes, it does happen. So how can Proverbs say that this, how can this be a true verse? Well, again, the key to understanding Proverbs is to view them in light of Jesus and in light of eternity. So don't view them in terms of the immediate, in terms of the immediacy of it. A guy named Mark Dever, he's a pastor in Washington, D.C., he said this, and this is kind of a, I'll try to make this clear. It sounds confusing. I'll try to make it clear for you. He says, generally, these things are true immediately, but they will always be true ultimately. Okay, I'll say it again. Generally speaking, these words are true in the immediate, but they will always be true ultimately. What he means by that is, for the most part, people that are faithful and people that, you know, put their hand to the plow and work hard, and they're probably not going to go hungry. But yes, it does happen sometimes. But ultimately, even for the Christian that's going hungry, if they die of starvation, ultimately, nothing will truly bring them harm from eternal perspective. So that's the idea that he's getting at there. So the wicked might make more money now, and the righteous might be starving now, but in the end, that's going to be reversed. How do we know that? Well, look at the life of Jesus. Because think of, who's the person that betrayed Jesus? What's his name? Judas Iscariot. So think of how things turned out in the immediate and long term for Judas and for Jesus. Judas betrays Jesus. He got some money. He got the quick fix. He got wealthy by really in the immediate. But ultimately, he ends up, it implodes. He tragically takes his own life. And then, of course, Jesus goes to the cross. He dies the death that you and I deserve. 3 days later, he rises again. He's resurrected from death. He defeats death and defeats sin, the power of sin. So think of how just in that little story of Jesus and Judas, how this idea comes to bear on that situation. Jesus is given victory over death. That victory applies to us if we're in Christ. So in the immediate, things didn't seem like they were going to work out. But then, of course, long term, we see how it played out. Look at, again, at verses 4 and 5. Again, remember, the words in here that we see here, these are generally true. So hard work usually leads to better financial outcomes than laziness. But, of course, there are exceptions. But there's a person that's lazy that just, like, wins a lottery. That happens sometimes. There are people who work really hard, and then things don't always work out as they plan. You ever notice that people, like, rarely admit to being lazy? People can say things like, yeah, I struggle with this or this or this, fill in the blank. But people almost never will say, like, yeah, I really struggle with laziness. Almost no one ever admits that. Because there's always someone else that you can think of that you're like, I'm not like them. And so by comparison, you think, I'm not lazy because I know someone who's truly lazy and I don't live like they live. So we play this comparison game. We do that sometimes. And we think almost no one ever will admit that they're truly the sluggard, as Proverbs describes, or that they're lazy. But in Proverbs, laziness refers to people who start something, but they don't follow through and finish it. When I read this week, I was super convicted. Because this is so prevalent in our age of distraction today, that we constantly have things competing for our attention, don't we? And we will start things and not finish things. It was really interesting. My week this week just got away from me. And normally I try to do these talks. I'll do talk prep on like Tuesday morning and Thursday morning, try to finish it by Thursday. This week was not one of those weeks. I felt so distracted for some reason, and I just could not get into a groove. I was working on this talk even past yesterday, past lunchtime, because of my own laziness and my own inability to focus for the week and get my stuff done. And I know that you struggle with the exact same thing. you struggle in the same way where you will start something and then you don't finish it. You don't follow through and finish it. That's what's being described here in the book of Proverbs. I think of the analogy here. It says, in verse 5, it says, he who gathers in summer is a prudent son, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who brings shame. Now, this is an agrarian society back then, mostly. And I told you before, my grandfather was a farmer. And so this verse rings true for me, because what if a farmer plants his crops in the spring and then he just hits the snooze button all throughout the harvest? What's going to happen if he does that? Well, he's going to waste all of his work, right? All that he did before that is just wasted. So how might this apply to how we live today? Like, you start something and you're doing good. You're doing really good at something. And then you just flame out and you don't finish it. You don't follow through on it. And all the work you did up to that point just goes away. It's wasted because you didn't finish the job. You didn't finish what you started. So notice in verse 5, the writer doesn't call this person a fool, but it says a son who brings shame. Now we can put daughter in there, can't we, ladies? We can say daughter. But here it says it's son, a son who brings shame. Now, laziness doesn't simply affect the person who's lazy. It affects those around them. I think the language used here is like family language, because when we're lazy, it's not just yourself you're affecting. You're affecting your family, and you're affecting your team. You're affecting your people at school that are relying upon you and expect you to do certain things. So it's like a relationship language being described here. It affects the community. It affects the family, where this person is exhibiting their laziness. Because someone else has to pick up the slack for what you're not doing. The next section here is Jesus gives wisdom for our words in verses 8 through 11. It says, the wise of heart will receive commandments, but a babbling fool will come to ruin. Whoever walks in integrity walks securely, but he who makes his ways crooked will be found out. Whoever, I love this verse, whoever winks the eye causes trouble. And a babbling fool will come to ruin. The mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. Someone who is wise will be someone who listens to what others have to say. They seem interested and curious to learn from other people. This person will ask questions because they know that they don't know everything. Have you ever talked with someone who just seems like they're not listening to anything that you're saying? Do you know people like that, where you're sharing something? It could be something very hard to share, and it just looks like they're just waiting for you to finish so they can say something. Like, they're just waiting for you to stop speaking so they can speak. That's what's being described, I think, here in verse 8. And then in verse 10, if someone says something and they wink when they say it, this is a weird idea, because I didn't really realize that winking was like an ancient world thing too. It's like, no one like does that today, right? But the idea being, if someone says something to you, but they wink when they say it, what does that mean? They're not really telling you the truth. They're being shady. They're being deceptive. There's something nefarious going on, right? And so that's the image being portrayed here. So if no one winks, of course, in that way, but like if someone says something and it's like they're not being honest, they're not being fully forthright, they're being deceptive, that's what verse 10 is describing. You can't trust what they're saying. In verse 11, it talks about the picture of this, the mouth being compared to like a fountain. So a positive view of that is one who uses their words to bring life. The negative view is just one who never stops talking. Like, imagine a fountain just spewing forth water all the time. That could be the negative image of the fountain. Like, that someone is just, they never stop. They never pause. They're just talking all the time. And in chapter 10, verse 19, it says that when someone uses too many words, when they just never stop talking, sin usually isn't far behind. Look at verse 19. When words are many, transgression is not lacking, but whoever restrains his lips is prudent. Usually the more we talk, the more we get into trouble. If we talk a lot, we're probably going to end up sharing someone else's secrets or talk negatively about someone else or share gossip about someone else, my rule for gossip is fairly simple, and it's this. If the person you are speaking with isn't part of the problem or part of the solution, then you shouldn't be talking to them. If the person you're speaking with isn't the person that you have an issue with or part of the solution, like helping you resolve a certain issue, then you probably shouldn't be talking to the person that you're talking to. So what motivates us to share things that we shouldn't share with people? What do we gain from that? I want you to search your own heart. Ask yourself this question. Whenever I feel tempted to share something with someone else that I know I shouldn't share, what am I truly gaining from that situation? What am I feeling? What am I doing? Why am I doing this? Is it to prop myself up, to make myself the center of attention, to make myself look like I'm this informant that has all the information on everybody else in our friend group? What's motivating that whenever we do those kinds of things? We live in an age today in which we downplay what we say. I've heard people say things like this, especially during political season, like, don't focus on what that person says, focus on what's in their heart. I've heard those words used of people and also of politicians. We like to separate what people say from who they are. And listen, Jesus doesn't let us do that. Because in Luke chapter 6, verse 45, it says, Jesus is saying this. He says, the good person out of the good treasure of his heart produces good, and the evil person out of his evil treasure produces evil, for out of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaks. We can't separate what comes out of our mouths from what's in our heart. Because what's in your heart is going to come out of your mouth. So if you say things, if you use certain words, if you tell certain jokes, if you tell certain stories, and someone says, hey, like, you're a Christ follower, I don't think you should be talking that way. And your response is like, well, I'm just saying, these are just words. Like, words don't really matter. No, they do matter. The Bible, Jesus says here, what's in your heart is going to come out of your mouth. From the heart, the mouth speaks. We can't separate those things. So words are really important. The next statement is, Jesus gives wisdom for our relationships. And we see in verse 12, it says, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all offenses. And again, if you go to the next chapter in the same chapter 11, verse 12, it says, whoever belittles his neighbor lacks sense, but a man of understanding remains silent. Verse 11 says, the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. And I want you to see these words. They're in contrast with the words in chapter 10, verse 12, where it says, love covers all offenses. So wicked, foolish people, they conceal truth for their own gain. We see that in chapter 11, verse 12. But wise, loving people, they cover over an offense. So this idea of concealing versus covering. So the covering being described in chapter 10, verse 12, it promotes healed relationships, the way that a bandage covers over a wound. So on November 17th, mark your calendars for this, in like 2 weeks, I guess, we'll do a sermon in here from Proverbs called Repairing Friendships. We've done talks before on friendship. This will be on repairing friendships. Many of us don't know how to foster true friendship, and if things go south in our friendships, we don't know what to do about it. We don't know how to fix it. So I want you to be here. Mark it down. November 17th, we'll do a talk called Repairing Friendship, because we have to learn how to do this well with one another. How do we cover over an offense and bring healing to our friendships in that way? Now, there are some people that are just always in conflict. Like, you know who they are. You might be one of those people. And they act like it's a mystery. They're just like, I don't understand. Like, everyone's just always in conflict with me. And we're over here going like, if there's some kind of misunderstanding or a situation, some kind of drama, they're just always stirring up strife. And when they're confronted on that reality, it's never their fault. Someone else is always to blame. And listen, if conflict is always following you around, it's not everyone else. It's you. You're at the center of it. It's got to be you. There's something you're doing in your relationships that's causing this. If it's following you, it's not a mystery. It's not a mystery to us as to why those things are happening. You know, some people are told things in, confidence, and then a few days later, what do they do? They go say to someone else, like, hey, I'm only going to tell you this, and you have to promise me that you won't tell anybody else. But did you know that? And they go on with their story. And then what happens? Well, that person that you just told, like, they do the exact same thing that you just did. They go tell someone else, say, hey, I need to tell you something. I need to promise that you won't tell anybody else. And then word gets back to you that that person told, and now you're angry at that person. But how can you be upset? Because they just did what you just did. You see how that works? So why do we feel the need to share someone else's secrets? Does it make you feel powerful? Does it make you feel self-important? Remember, if you want to know where our idols are, follow the foolishness. Where are we struggling with idolatry? In Proverbs chapter 11, verse 12, we see a concept that applies directly to many of us here in the room, because it says, whoever belittles his neighbor lacks sense, but a man of understanding remains silent. A favorite thing, a favorite pastime for young men is to make fun of each other. We all know this to be true, right? But listen, we've got to understand that, like, everyone doesn't receive it the way that you think they receive it. So this idea of belittling people, this happens with girls and guys. I'm picking on the guys for a minute. But we know guys, they say it's their way of, like, relating and it's good-natured fun. I get that. That can happen sometimes. But sometimes we overdo it and you hurt people. And, of course, one of the sins of being a man is to say to another guy, like, you hurt my feelings, because that's also not being manly, right? So they can't ever share when you've crossed the line because of the rules of being a man, right? So, like, they're just stuck with, like, I guess I got to deal with it and just live in this reality as a man. And that's just a sad place for us to be in. So why don't we follow this verse and not belittle each other? It says here, like, if you do that incessantly, you lack sense. Like, you're kind of borderline what Proverbs calls a fool when you do that. I can remember all the people in, like, my high school that we used to make fun of. And I wish I could go back and make it right. Because, like, there's a lot of hurt that I know that my friendship group caused. And what do we get from that? Just, like, propping ourselves up like that. So for our young men especially, think before you speak. And think before you put someone else down and belittle someone else and make them feel less than human. So what do we do? Well, we've got to learn the art, like this verse says. It says, man of understanding remains silent. So, like, when someone truly gets it, they know when to shut their mouth. They know when to be quiet and not say stupid things, right? This is what Jonathan Aiken writes. He says, being a blood-bought, wise Christian means that you see the way God dealt with you and your sin and your offense against him, then you deal that way with others who wrong you. So you love them and you forgive them. So we often give ourselves a pass much quicker than we give others a pass. We are so quick to receive grace for ourselves, but so slow to offer it to someone else. So listen, don't be a hypocrite and receive the gospel of grace and not be willing to give it. The last point is that Jesus gives wisdom leading to blessing. This could be, again, this could be some blessing now, but definitely blessing later on. So I'm just going to read this section. We're going to close very quickly here in a second. Verse 24, it says, what the wicked dreads will come upon him, but the desire of the righteous will be granted. When the tempest passes, the wicked is no more, but the righteous is established forever. Like vinegar to the teeth and smoke to the eyes. So like just irritating. So is the sluggard to those who send him. The fear of the Lord prolongs life, but the years of the wicked will be short. The hope of the righteous brings joy, but the expectation of the wicked will perish. The way of the Lord is a stronghold to the blameless, but destruction to evildoers. The righteous will never be removed, but the wicked will not dwell in the land. The mouth of the righteous brings forth wisdom, but the perverse tongue will be cut off. The lips of the righteous know what is acceptable, but the mouth of the wicked, what is perverse. Whenever we read Proverbs, it's easy to feel discouraged, like, I don't feel like I'm living out this stuff very well at all. And so we evaluate our lives, and we think, like, how I've messed up. Like, I've just told you that I've messed up over the years. We can often remember how we've made bad decisions, and we've brought sadness to our parents. We can remember how we've hurt people with our words. We recall how we've ignored people who love us and care for us and not followed their advice and their wisdom. We remember how we've shared secrets that we should have kept or how we didn't forgive someone who wronged us. Listen, the point of this book isn't to beat ourselves up, trying to make ourselves better in our own strength. You've got to read Proverbs with this gospel lens. This guy, Graham Goldsworthy, says this: Jesus has fulfilled in our place the perfection that God demands. He was the truly wise and sanctified human on our behalf. Thus, as we struggle to become wise, we know that our failures do not disqualify us from life because Christ himself is our only qualification. He, when all is said and done, is our wisdom. And to possess Christ is to be accounted wise by the only judge who matters. You guys are going to head to your breakouts. If you don't know where to go, come and ask me. You guys should know to go. Should know where to go at this point. Leaders' discussion questions are at the very back on top of the sound booth, and you guys can head to discussion.